is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.
You are Locked On Cavaliers, your daily podcast on the Cleveland Cavaliers. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team, every day.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Locked On Cavaliers, your daily Cleveland Cavaliers podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day, and brought to you by Fear the Sword, SB Nation's Cleveland Cavaliers blog. Today, we have a fun show. I talked to Chris Herring from 538 about LeBron James, about LeBron's passing, about the Cavs, about Kyrie Irving, and a bunch of other things. It was one of my favorite podcasts to do. It kind of came together last minute, so we're not going to talk too much about the Jazz game that takes place later today, but I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation with Chris. He's one of my favorite writers to read. Talked about his process as a journalist as well, so a little bit of it is a nerdy journalism-y discussion, but I think you guys are going to enjoy it. If you don't already follow Chris on Twitter, you can do so at Herring_NBA, and you should be following him because he's great. You probably also know him from the work he did at the Wall Street Journal covering the New York Knicks, and that is really where he made his name. The Cavs do have a game later today against the Utah Jazz. It's a 7 o'clock game, another 7 o'clock game. The Cavs' third-to-last home game of the month. They're not going to be home again until the 25th when they play the Wizards. A couple news and notes about that game. It is possible that Kevin Love and Kyle Korver will play. I wouldn't bet on them playing, maybe one of them. But it looks like we're getting close to the Cavs being at full strength again, which is pretty interesting. Larry Sanders may be with the team, but don't expect him to play like he did in his debut on Tuesday. He practiced with the Charge on Wednesday, so perhaps we'll hear a little bit about what that was like for him. And Ty Lue also noted that J.R. Smith is probably going to start sooner rather than later. So we're going to get back to the Kyrie Irving, J.R. Smith, LeBron James, Kevin Love, Tristan Thompson starting five that won the title last year. We're getting close to the Cavs being the peak Cavs again. It feels like forever since that has been the case, but we're getting there. And the Jazz are going to be a tough game. A few things to watch in that game for me include how the Cavs attack Rudy Gobert, how minutes are managed, and just a few other kind of interesting things about that game. Jazz are really good. If you want more, go check out Locked On Jazz. It's a great daily Jazz podcast. You'll learn a lot about Utah from David Locke, the founder of the Locked On Podcast Network. And he does a really great job. They did beat Detroit on Wednesday night, so they're coming in on the back-to-back, so the Cavs maybe have an advantage there. But it should be a great game. The Jazz are really, really good. This game matters for both teams as well because they're both jockeying for positioning in their respective conferences. The Cavs, of course, are number one in the East, but trying to hold on. And the Jazz are in a battle with the Clippers for the four seed, where the winner of those two teams are probably going to have home court in what I think it's probably the best first-round series, regardless of conference, would be Jazz Clippers. So, that's going on tonight. We'll have a recap of the game up tomorrow on Friday before we get into the Cavs' weekend games in L.A. Also, I will be attending the Chargers game against the Windy City Bulls on Saturday to check out Larry Sanders. So, we're going to have some look at Larry Sanders' D-League game, perhaps some Kay Felder if he ends up playing in Canada on Saturday as expected. But today, Chris Herring from 538, 30-minute conversation touching on LeBron's passing, his article, LeBron and Harden are the best quarterbacks in the NBA, his process, Kyrie Irving, the Cavs in general as a contender. I think you're going to enjoy it. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
You're listening to Love Advice with Leanne. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Leanne. Longtime listener, first-time caller. Why, in your professional opinion, do you never take my calls off the air?
Is this Carl?
Yep, it's Carl. I mean, we had a few dates. Everything was great, I thought.
Well, you know, when you switch to GEICO, you could save a lot of money on car insurance.
Okay, awesome.
You should call them.
I will.
GEICO, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
So, Chris, before we get into the article you wrote about LeBron and Harden's passing, you made a switch from covering the Knicks for the Wall Street Journal to moving to 538, covering, and you moved to a very different type of outlet, not a newspaper, but like a new age journalism thing, a Nate Silver thing. How has your job changed covering the NBA now that you're at 538?
It's changed a lot. Maybe even in some ways that I didn't anticipate. You know, I think people who read my work enough have kind of come to see me as a numbers person. I've never really considered myself a numbers person. I just gave a talk in front of journalism students at Michigan, where I went to school, my alma mater. And it's very clear that they kind of view me as a reporter that is very heavily rooted in numbers. And I guess I use numbers a lot. But I hate math. Like, I'm not good at it. I'm confused about the way some people use it. And as we speak, I'm sitting here like going through a story where I didn't necessarily invent a stat, but I kind of made a suggestion for a stat in a story and kind of built it around a player that we're going to roll out in the next week or so. And so, I mean, I guess I am more numerically inclined than I realized at one point. And I guess everybody at 538 is kind of more like that. Whereas at the Wall Street Journal, numbers were seemingly optional. You know, it was kind of more of a traditional place. I think I infused a little bit of new age stuff in the way they did some sports reporting. And there are other people there that do that too. But there, I think people were kind of just thrilled at any number I used. Whereas here I've turned stuff in and they've said, you know, this is a little bit light on numbers. Is there anything else you want to add in there? And so that's been different. And also kind of, you know, looking around at how numerically inclined some of the people I work with are, that I'm kind of like the lightweight in the room in terms of how well I understand the numbers, how often I use Excel. I never was really using Excel before at the journal. I did a lot of stuff by hand. And I think the rigor with which they check numbers and, you know, the way they think about numbers and the different statistics that they use to introduce the idea of how well someone's playing or how poorly someone's playing, it's just very different from the way I operated. And it makes for, they have editors that their whole job is to check how accurate or how honest a number is. And so even if a number is accurate, if you're not giving it the full context, we have quantitative editors at 538. Their whole job is to copy edit stories and mostly just to focus on the numbers and nothing else. And so, you cannot pull a fast one on anyone there really. And I think I like that element of it. I think it's just kind of challenged me even more on that front. And the initial battle that I remember having with them is, you know, there will be a lot of stories where I have a very good sense of something, a very heavy inclination on something. And, you know, they'll want to run the story as is. And I'm like, I still need to go talk to the player. I want to do the reporting behind it. Yeah. Aside from just watching film, aside from just, you know, looking at a number and the statistic blowing us away. You know, that's kind of my bread and butter as far as I'm concerned, is the idea of actually interviewing these guys and setting it apart from, you know, a blogger that might be really industrious and find some of the stuff on their own in terms of the numbers or something that they're seeing on film. I've got access to these players. And so that's kind of what allows me to set a lot of my work apart. So that's been a challenge. And covering the league as a whole, I think, has probably been an even bigger challenge. You know, covering the Knicks for 4 or 5 years, you get used to seeing certain things. You kind of understand how they operate or what they're doing on offense or defense. And so trying to cover the league as a whole when you haven't been watching these teams once or twice or three times a week and needing to do that so that you can write a good profile on a player or a team or a coach. That's a huge, huge difference. And I know I'm friends with Zach Lowe and a lot of other guys in the industry, and Zach and other people have told me it's going to take you a while to kind of build a baseline so that you can recognize when something different is happening, when a team starts changing what it's done for weeks and all of a sudden they start, you know, using something else. It's going to take you a while to kind of build up that context and that baseline. And so, a couple of people told me it would take the whole season, and I've learned that was absolutely true. And so I think my work is starting to get stronger now as I've kind of understood some of these teams a little bit better and watching more of their games.
Do you have a way to decide when you're going to watch a specific team besides writing about them and how much you're going to watch that team? If you're like looking for a story idea, how do you decide who to watch and how many games of theirs you're going to watch?
No, I mean, sometimes if I know I'm writing about a team or if I know I want to, then I'll start watching them more. My DVR, my girlfriend and I fight over my DVR because It's, you know, some weeks it will get 78% full over the course of like 2 days, when the day before it might have been 52. When I basically record every single game that's on, and then I'll make a decision the next day about what I'm keeping and what I'm deleting, or what I really need to look at or what I don't. But no, I mean, a lot of times I was watching a random game a couple weeks ago just because I felt like I needed to catch up on the Magic a little bit. And it was right after the Ibaka trade, and so Terrence Ross was playing there. And I came across a play that they ran for him, just a double screen, sending him around a screen on the perimeter so he could get an open jumper on the wing. And, you know, they came back from a timeout, and after they did, the sideline reporter for the Magic, I think his name is Dante Marchitelli, had this anecdote, basically, that he was saying that he was kind of near the huddle so that he could kind of hear what was being said. And he said that Frank Vogel had just made a point to tell Terrence Ross that they're going to run a play for him, and that it was the same play that the Raptors had run for Terrence Ross several times against Frank Vogel when he was the coach of the Pacers. And so he said, every time you ran this play against me, you either got a three out of it or you got a dunk. And so we're hoping that it'll work here. And it was his first game as a member of the Magic. And of course he got a wide open three out of it, knocked it down. It was the first basket he made as a Magic player. And so, you know, I was able to go back and look at film of that and see how he was killing the Pacers with that play. And it also probably speaks to a lot of the reason that Frank Vogel would have been excited to have him come in and play on his team. And so I think that's a pretty eye-opening thing. Mm-hmm. I didn't go in with any intent of watching the Magic specifically for any one reason. You watch the game so that you can kind of be enlightened on stuff like that. You know, if I hadn't heard the sideline reporter say that, maybe it's something I noticed on my own, probably not to that extent. But that's how you watch the games, so you can kind of get that sort of insight that there's really no other way to know that sort of thing. You know, you can watch plenty of games, but you need to try to watch, you know, every team a couple times over the course of a couple weeks, because otherwise it's just, you know, there's no context for anything if you're not able to watch the teams often enough. And you know, every team goes through their changes over the course of the year.
The last thing about this before we get to the article you wrote, when you ask players questions that are based, sort of form based on stats that you've seen, how do you form those questions? Are you including the stat in the question, or are you just kind of trying to ask that question without trying to say, oh, you have, you know, like XX usage rate? Like, how do you do that?
Yeah. You know what? It's funny because for me that's natural, and it's probably because I started in a place where I was just a pretty traditional sports reporter. I mean, I had things that I tried to pick up on from other reporters that I'd heard and watched and worked with before. But truthfully, I mean, I did this before I ever really used numbers in the way I do now. And so the interviewing was pretty routine for me. And I think I went through some of those struggles too when I did start using more numbers, where people kind of give you this really crazy looking face and they're like, what are you even talking about? And so you realize really quickly you can't just kind of assault them with numbers. You know, I think there's kind of an art to it. It depends on what you're writing about sometimes. Sometimes if you don't give a direct enough explanation or kind of lay out what you're doing or what you're trying to write about or why it's different, then it's not going to help. And you're not going to get a quote that really speaks to what you're talking about. But sometimes you can kind of just let the observation ask your question or provide the question. And so two examples. One, I went down to Oklahoma City a couple weeks ago. My whole story was about why Russell Westbrook was going left in one-on-one plays 75% of the time, which was, you know, a career high for him, still is a career high, and was pretty much the highest rate in the league of any guy that, you know, that handles the ball a lot. And so I just handed him a sheet. I'd taken down each number, you know, left versus right for each year. And I showed that to him, and I figured, you know, it's such a specific question. If I don't lay it out this way, he's not going to understand what I'm talking about. If I just say, it seems like you're going left, he could easily say, well, it might seem that way, but I'm not, you know, and he wouldn't. I have better access to the numbers and understanding the numbers than he would just, mm-hmm. you know, just kind of on a whim. So I needed to in that situation. Other times though, you know, I can just ask Carmelo a question. Like, I remember I covered the Knicks and I was writing a story. I had access to numbers that showed that from the first time, the second time, third time, and fourth time that he plays an opponent over the course of the season, that his numbers progressively get better each time. Field goal percentage, effective field goal percentage, points, assists, in some cases rebounds too. But basically, it spoke to the fact that he was picking up on things on film. And in particular, the reason I wrote the story, he had just played really, really well against the Bucks, I think it was. and they had just played the Bucks the week before, and then he played them again and then had like a monster game. And, you know, and I noticed from having watched the first game that he was kind of picking up on where the double teams were going to come from, because they were playing the same sort of defense that they did the week before against him. And so he was seeing the same things twice. And I asked him, how does it change your focal point and your vantage point when you kind of know what to expect from a certain team, or when you've played a team in kind of short proximity to the last time you played them? And he walked me through it, and he told me what he looks at, what he looks for, how he tries to set other guys up. And so I didn't mention anything to him about numbers in that case. I knew what the numbers were, but I don't think it's always necessary to kind of inform someone completely of exactly what statistic you've pulled. Because A, there's not really enough time in the day to walk them through every single number that you've used or that you've pulled. But also you don't want to kind of confuse them with, you know, you just kind of want to get their natural response. And the more that you kind of bury them with numbers, the less free form the response is going to be. And so, no, I don't always use numbers to ask a question. Sometimes I think you kind of need to give them a better context, but other times I don't think you need to. And I think that's one thing that hopefully people can kind of glean from the response I just gave you, is that I don't think you have to, I don't think it always impresses players to kind of look at their numbers. Sometimes I think people are turned off by that because it's not something that they really want to know or that they're really inclined to change, you know, and they kind of feel like they're trying to be forced into changing something if you ask a question about it. So it depends. But then again, you can get great numbers, use great numbers, and then get really funny responses out of JR in terms of the contested shots versus the uncontested, or the catch and shoot versus the off the dribble shots, where he's way better with one versus the other. So who knows?
How did Russ react when you handed him a sheet of stats? Like, what was his, how does he react to that?
He looked at him for about 10 or 15 seconds as I walked him through the premise of the story. And then he kind of started to hand them back. And I said, if you want, you can keep them, because I understand, you know, it's a pretty heavy sort of question in terms of the statistics and a very specific sort of thing in terms of one-on-one drives to one direction versus the other. And I said, so you can keep those if you'd like. I don't need them back. He said, no, 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 I don't want them. And he, like, kind of threw it back at me. In terms of the sheet, I mean, he is a perfect example of someone that obviously cares very much about his numbers from, you know, one standpoint, in terms of the triple double race and everything. And I think people have written plenty about how it kind of seems like he's very, 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 very intent on getting certain types of plays that help him get to those numbers. But I don't think, you know, when someone's playing as fast and as hard as he is, I don't think he's as concerned about the minutiae of left versus right. I mean, and he basically said, I'm taking what the defense gives me. I don't really know that I'm as focused on that as you are. And I mean, not in like a rude way or anything like that, but I don't expect people to pay that close of attention to it. You know, LeBron, I actually think might pay attention to that sort of thing. Maybe not publicly in terms of responding in a quote, but you know, a lot of these guys do have analytics coaches and that will tell them left versus right and kind of break down for them if they're playing more efficiently from one side of the floor than the other. Or if they're playing against a certain team, might tell them about a defender's tendency. But I don't think, just in general, you know, in a public setting, I don't think that they really are going to want to know that much, or that they would actually divulge that much. And honestly, there were people that emailed me that were fans of the Thunder that said, why would you write this? Because obviously, if you write this and you have a big enough following, people are going to pick up on that. Yeah. And pick up on what his tendencies are. And that's not, you know, I get where they're coming from, I guess, but that's not really my job to be concerned about that sort of thing.
No, not at all. It's like a fact. That's, I mean, that's a great lead into a Russell Westbrook story, because he's covered in the same way, kind of a lot. Like, he's the this berserker, you know, go at the rim guy. But if he's, you can add nuance that, I think that's really important. So the LeBron and Harden piece, for those that want to read it if they haven't already, it's called LeBron and Harden Are the NBA's Best Quarterbacks. First off, what made you set out to write the story, and how long does this take you to turn around a story like this?
It depends on what, you know, where are we starting in terms of the formation of the story. I watched a game. Almost every time I sit and watch LeBron in person, you're kind of mesmerized by how good the guy is at basketball. Yeah. It doesn't really limit itself to any one thing. It's not just his scoring. It's not just his ability to kind of race down the floor and make a chase down block. It's not just his ability to really lock down and make a good defensive play here or there. It's not just his passing. It's kind of everything all together. And I've always said that the way that I can measure how good someone is and is how quickly it seems like they get to a triple double or close to it without you really noticing it as being like somehow out of the norm for them. You know, LeBron can play poorly or seemingly poorly for him by his standards and still get to those sorts of numbers. And he's been doing that for years. Whether or not he actually got a triple double in those games was one thing, but the fact that he could get to 24, 8, and 7, and you actually feel like he's not even really impacting the game that much. The fact that he kind of creeps up on those numbers tells you that like we expect him to get there. And so he's done that forever. But I remember watching one game, I can't remember which one it was. And I just, him rifling the ball around the floor and just finding guys all over the court. And I remember having an interest in trying to figure out who throws the ball the hardest in the league. And, you know, there are obviously numbers on that. He wasn't necessarily the person that threw the ball the hardest. I want to say it was like Jrue Holiday or something that threw his passes on average the hardest. And then Rubio was right behind him. But what I ended up asking instead is like, okay, so I have hardest, but I don't really think it's that interesting, you know, because guys are kind of bunched up together. They all throw the ball about as hard as the next person. But when you looked at who threw the ball the farthest most often, I figured that would be LeBron. And then as I asked for the data on it, it was actually Harden by a pretty good margin. And then LeBron by a pretty good margin ahead of the guy that was in number three, in the number three spot. And so I figured, you know, maybe right about the two of them, looked at the calendar to see when they were set to play next. And it wasn't until March. I had this idea in like mid or late January. And so we decided to kind of just hold the story until then. And I did some reporting in between and went to the All-Star game and was able to get those two guys there to talk about the idea of how they're able to kind of find guys that far away from them. You know, the number that I used in the story was basically 30 feet or more in terms of their passes they were making. And I think Harden, it was a quarter of his passes that were traveling that far. It was 20 or 21% of LeBron's passes traveling that far. And then nobody else in the league was even at 15%. I think he had Wall at like 14. Yeah. And so just a huge gap between those two. And why was that? And getting to the bottom of why that was. And so obviously the offenses are spaced out, but I think there's a lot more to it than that. And so I tried to kind of dig into those things while I was reporting, while I was interviewing them, tried to show examples of it. And I think, you know, talking to some guys that I was pretty comfortable with already. I obviously covered Derek Williams in New York, and I was watching games to try to see, you know, what sorts of passes these guys are making, where are they making them from. And I was also really interested in the fact that, you know, there's so many buyouts and so many guys that they've been picking up through waivers that, you know, what is it like for some of these guys when they just join the team to play with a player like LeBron? And I thought it was really telling that Derek Williams, kind of his first game, had a mishap trying to handle a pass from LeBron and why that was. And I immediately thought he doesn't look ready. When I watched the replay of it several times, it just didn't seem like he was ready. And so I remember going to ask him about that in Boston a couple of weeks ago. And that was basically exactly what he said. It's just that he wasn't prepared for LeBron to be able to make the sort of pass that he did. And so that was the way I led the story.
Are you surprised Derek Williams has been this isn't like a big question obviously, but are you surprised that he's been as effective in the minutes he's played with the Cavs after kind of how he was with the Knicks and how he was with the Heat?
A little. I mean, I will say this. A lot of Knicks fans wanted him back. He can be an effective player. I think the question with him is kind of at what point do his limitations start to show? And obviously that's true of him. That's true of JR. That's true of Shumpert. That's true of anybody. But the more good players you have on a team, the more you can cover for someone's shortcomings. And so, you know, I don't think they're particularly good on defense. Maybe they are, but, you know, it's a team that kind of puts a switch. And so that part of it, you know, his defense doesn't really hinder them a ton because they're already not that good. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, maybe that hasn't hurt them as much as it otherwise would if they were a really good team and, you know, you're plugging a pretty poor defender in there. But I don't think they need him to do much. And that was kind of what I tried to highlight in the story to some extent, was that they really need him to knock down threes occasionally. He's not a real good three-point shooter. And they need him to just be able to make plays when guys get him the ball. I mean, that's pretty much what he does. He can push the ball in open court if and when he gets a rebound. But he's not a great passer. He's not a great shooter. But he's a pretty physically imposing guy. And he's another scoring option for them. And I think they needed one at a time where JR was out and where Kevin Love is out. So he gives them some things. I don't expect him to be a huge difference maker in the playoffs, but I'm not sure that they're going to ask him to do that or be that, especially once Love is back playing. And, you know, if JR is able to kind of knock off some of the rust and if they're able to get stuff out of Shumpert. So we'll see how that goes. But I'm not totally convinced he's a totally different player. But if and when he becomes one, or if he is one, I think it's because LeBron. LeBron just makes guys that much better. But I think that, you know, the Deron Williams acquisition, I think, will end up being more important because they're going to really need him to step up as a backup point guard. Whereas with Deron Williams, when you factor in certain guys playing more minutes with it being the playoffs, I don't think he's going to be quite as big a factor as someone like Deron Williams is.
Yeah, I'll say this about Deron Williams. I do think there's a chance they, based on what they've said and how they talk about him, I think there's a chance they try to use him in a possible Golden State matchup. I really think they might. Just because of the fact that he's a bigger guy than like a Shumpert, and he can move a little bit, like he can theoretically move better than a Korver. You know, I mean, he's not, obviously not the shooter that a Korver is, and he's not, he can really just dunk is what he does best in offense. But I think there's a chance they're gonna try to make him a 5-minute guy if they play the Warriors and the Warriors go death lineup. The one stat that I found really interesting in this piece was that at least at the time of the writing, 6 of the 20 players who had drained the most threes in the league this season had played with on either the Cavs or the Rockets. I mean, obviously, both those teams have loaded up on shooting, the Rockets in particular, loaded up with Eric Gordon and Ryan Anderson and all those guys. But is that kind of statistic really partially possible because of who's really pushing the ball around and who's leading the offense for both those teams?
I mean, I was trying to figure that part out. I mean, it's probably like one of those chicken and egg questions where – you know, they have great players to kind of set everybody up on the roster, unlike a lot of teams do. And because of that, you're going to load up on shooters because you've got LeBron and you've got James Harden, and they have really, really gifted passing ability. It was actually funny when I wrote the story, we held it a day or two longer than I thought we would. And so over the course of holding the story, I think Kyrie fell out of the top 20. He was actually 21st in the league and three-pointers made when I wrote. So it was 7 of the top 21 guys from those two teams. And Kevin Love would have been on the list as well, I'm pretty sure, had he not been hurt. And so you would have realistically had 8 of the top 20 guys from just those two teams. So I think part of it is the passing ability. Part of it is that when you put all those guys on one team, you're going to space the defense out in a way that basically breaks them. They cannot possibly cover all those guys in one play. You have to give up something. You have to sacrifice something. And in a lot of cases, it's the shooter. In other cases, it's going to be that you have to guard LeBron or Harden one-on-one, which is not ideal, but, you know, it's dangerous to even bring over help, because if you do that, then you're leaving open another shooter. So there's just really not a good answer. That was the point I was trying to make in the story, is that these two guys have an ability to break the defense in a way that other guys don't quite have. Oklahoma City doesn't really have the shooting to do that. Golden State can do it. And obviously they're at one point were on pace to have the most efficient offense of all time. So they're obviously able to do it too, but they've been doing that. I don't really think anything is different about their offense this year. Durant obviously gives them even more juice to do that, but that's not, you know, their offense was already kind of amazing. And I think, you know, that's to be expected when you've got 2 or 3 guys that are stars or superstars. And the Cavs, you know, you look at them, and obviously Kyrie can play that way and play at that level. But there are times where they look at that even if Kyrie's not really in the game. And the fact that they fall off so much when LeBron's not out there, it tells you that I think it's a much bigger function of what LeBron's able to do. Because I think they're like a +8 when he's on the court, but then a -7 or something like that when he's off. And so it speaks volumes about how well LeBron faces the floor in particular, when it's just him out there and Kyrie and Kevin aren't out there.
Yeah. Kyrie's actually the guy I'm going to bring up next. He obviously gets a lot of criticism, and I think some of it's fair for how it takes the brunt of the responsibility for how the Cavs play when LeBron isn't on the floor. But LeBron is like, I mean, it's not really fair to say unicorn, because we use unicorn to describe other things now, but he's asked to do, I think, different things than point guards do. But because of what LeBron does, because of his passing, because your LeBron James is an insane passer, like, you're going to let him lead the offense. Do you think that we should change how we should view what Kyrie's doing at a point guard position in that spot? Like, I think there's got to be some give and take there with him. He's not built to be a traditional point guard. It's why them having Deron Williams, I think, makes a lot of sense. But when you have LeBron, there's just not going to be as much opportunity for him to be that guy, I think.
Yeah, I mean, he's shown that he can do it occasionally. I think there's a line. You don't want him to be out there just setting everybody up, because LeBron can do that for the most part. Deron Williams can do that now as well. So it's not as vital for him to be a table setter. But you don't want him to have games where he's not even looking to help someone get a basket. I remember that, you know, the game, someone asked LeBron that one time, is it essentially unacceptable that Kyrie can go a game or two games at a time without having an assist? And I think you don't want him to be in that situation where guys can just try to load up on him, particularly when LeBron's not in the game. I think Kyrie obviously is capable of scoring in almost any situation. We've seen him score in traffic, but you don't want him out there just playing for himself. And I mean, he's capable of it, and I think there's a time and a place for it. We saw that during the finals. But yeah, when he's out there with LeBron, he can play differently. When he's out there by himself, that's what I think a lot of people would be interested in seeing. We've seen all the numbers about the win and loss record when LeBron's not there. We've seen the on-off numbers when LeBron's on the sideline. And so that's kind of the question, is how much has he grown? If he was out there by himself, how much growth would he have shown? And so I don't know that we have the answer to that question. You'd like to think that he's really improved and that the Cavs would be better if, you know, if something did happen to LeBron, then maybe they take a series anyway if something happens to LeBron. But I'm not really sure that that's the case, one. And two, I mean, I do think it's something where even though LeBron makes the people around him better, it's very, very clear that they would only be a championship-level team with him. I think we've seen more than enough evidence to know at this point that if he wasn't in the picture, that Kyrie could not carry this by himself and have them be a contender. And, you know, and I'm not sure what happens with his career in terms of whether he grows beyond that, but he's still such a fun player to watch. He's still a star regardless. But yeah, his skill set is not that of a traditional point guard, and I think we've known that for a long time.
His career arc is going to be really fascinating when he's like 32, because he started out playing for these very dysfunctional Cavs teams under Mike Brown and Byron Scott.
Yeah.
Bad draft picks. I mean, they tried to do the Deion and him thing. The Anthony Bennett pick hangs over his career. And then he goes from playing on these really bad teams to playing with LeBron James and playing with Kevin Love. Like, it's a big change for him. And then he's just had like a very weird arc. Like, he hasn't had that natural progression type thing. And I think there are certain things you can hold against him for the first couple of years, but I think some of it, his development was wonky, and he's turned out very well, obviously, but it's telling, like, that when he would play in these situations where he's playing with other really good players, he would do better. But when he's playing back in Cleveland and like Earl Clark is his starting small forward, and he's playing in a Mike Brown offense, things look bad. He also does, you're right, kind of, he does this thing where he looks like he gets like almost a phone booth with a guy when he wants to go at a guy. And Avery Bradley's the guy that I think of a lot for this. When they played the Celtics 2 weeks ago now, that when they lost that game in Boston, there was instances where Kyrie was just attacking Avery Bradley and ignoring everybody else. And I don't think that's ideal, especially for a team like Boston, where they're a good defensive team. They have other guys, but they're very beatable. And you could theoretically do that against Golden State too. Like, if he wants to go at Clay or he wants to go at someone like that, I think that's a bad tendency for Kyrie.
I do too. I mean, he's never really gotten away from that, almost where it looks like an all-star game. And it's just not necessary with the talent that he's got now. No, the team wouldn't be a championship team without LeBron, but there's more than enough talent to where you don't need to be that way. And when he's got the ability to get past people, that he can use that, you know, that ability to set other guys up. And so it is a little frustrating when you see that from him. I think that's what you hear people responding to, is just that, you know, that's the difference between a star and a superstar. When you make plays for other guys that cannot get a shot like that, where it's very clear that you could try to dominate the game from a scoring standpoint, but that you want to get other guys involved when you have to.
Yeah. And last question here, Kristen, because we've taken up far too much of your time. Where the Cavs are at right now, they're playing really well offensively. They just had this game against the Pistons where they had 100 points in three quarters without Love and without Kyle Korver. And we're getting close to the playoffs. Where do you think the Cavs stand right now?
I think they're vulnerable. I mean, I don't think there's any way around that, you know, looking at that. I mean, I do think that they have a tendency to kind of put their foot on the pedal, take their foot off. And so it's a little difficult to make sense of exactly what they are, what they would be. But yeah, it's just a different feeling this year where other teams have started to play really well. And you get the impression of like, well, you know, if LeBron was hurt, yeah, there's, you know, they obviously are not going to have a chance to really do much as a team if he's out of, you know, out of commission. But now it's starting to look like even if he's there, I could kind of see it happening. I don't necessarily think it would be Boston, but I look at a team like Washington. I think, you know, I could see that happening. If Toronto gets Lowry back and he's playing well and Ibaka's really firing on all cylinders and Tucker's there, you can kind of see how it could happen. I don't think it will, but you can see how it might. And so I'm interested to see how it all plays out.
Who do you think out of the three teams right below them in the East has the best chance of knocking them off?
I would probably give it to Washington right now. I don't know that the experience is going to be there, but I just like that team, and I'm not sure how it's going to play out. But I really do like Washington. They just seem to have enough offense, enough defense to really push them and make them nervous.
If Lowry was healthy, I think I would pick Toronto because of what he can do against Kyrie, and I think DeRozan is as frustrating as he can be. I think he makes it really hard to play Korver in certain situations, and I think Korver's just been so useful. But I just, with Lowry coming back from injury, and of course Kevin Love's coming off injury too, like I just don't feel great about Toronto at the moment.
Yeah, I still would like to see them gel a little bit more. I'm not sure, but I do really like Washington right now. I'm not sure that it'll work out for them, but I like what they've done. I like that they've kind of stuck to it, and it's just been a good season for them so far.
Yeah, that Cavs-Wizards game from about almost a month ago now, I think, was definitely one of the best games of the regular season.
One of my favorite ones of the year, for sure.
It was great. It had everything. I'm very down for the return of a Cavs-Wizards rivalry. If we're going to go back to LeBron's first time in Cleveland when Deshaun Stevenson and him were beefing and Soulja Boy got involved, like, I'd be very down for another DC kind of Cavs thing, especially if Soulja Boy just randomly gets involved again. Are there any other NBA storylines for you that you just are kind of watching as we get near the playoffs?
Not really. I mean, I'm kind of waiting for the playoffs to start just because I think we're kind of inventing storylines or talking about the ones that we've already known about with regards to the triple-double stuff and the MVP. We know this stuff already. Let's just see if anybody can really challenge LeBron this year. Let's see if Golden State can get there and if they can get past you know, whether it's a Wizards team, whether it's something else. I mean, we know all this stuff. It's not anything new. Let's just get to the playoffs.
Yeah, I'm kind of overhearing about the MVP race.
Me too. I've been over it since the first week of the season. I mean, it's been interesting, but we know this stuff already. Let's just see what happens.
Yeah, and let's just let the guys finish their full resume, right? Like Kawhi and Russ and Harden and LeBron, they all have their own – they still have like almost a month until the regular season's over. Let's let them see what they do the last 3 weeks. Like, let's see where they finish. And I think there's just still so much time left to the playoffs, and it's kind of a bummer because I really am excited for the playoffs, even though the first round might be a bit underwhelming. But once we actually get into the good of the playoffs, there's nothing better than that. And I do kind of hope that we don't see like the Cavs, what they did last year, where they pummeled Detroit, they beat Atlanta again, and then they you know, lose two games in Toronto, but they don't really feel threatened by that. I kind of want to see them push in a way we haven't seen them before. That, to me, before the finals, like, I want to see them push in the East. That, to me, would be more interesting than LeBron just running through the East again.
Yeah, I don't think that will happen. I don't think that they'll just run through it this year. I think that they're going to get challenged at some point. I'm not sure who's going to do it, but I do think that there's going to be some level of challenge there. Somebody, I'm hoping. Maybe it's just more than I'm hoping, but I do think that someone will push them. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, Chris, thank you so much for your time. Again, you can find all of Chris's work at 538, and we'll talk to you again soon.
I really appreciate it. Thank you. Napa
know-how. It takes a lot to get excited about a bag, but most bags can't save you 20% on auto parts. That's 20% off headlamps, 20% off oil filters, 20% off virtually anything you can fit inside the 99-cent Napa reusable bag. So tell your buddies, there's a bag they just have to check out. Quality parts, helpful people. That's Napa know-how. Napa know-how. At participating Napa Auto Parts stores while supplies last. Minimum 3 items. Exclusions apply. Offer ends 10/31/17.